Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Marketplace Discussions podcast. My name is Mahmoud Resmi, and today's guest is Jordan O'Connor. Jordan's story is an extremely interesting and an inspiring one. He graduated as an engineer with around $200,000 in student loan, and his first job was paying him around $80,000 a year. He was struggling to make ends meet and to pay back his loans, so he decided to try and build something on the side in order to generate an extra income. He dabbled around with several projects and learned some new skills and eventually developed an app called Closet Tools, which is a Poshmark automation tool. At some point in time, this became his full-time gig, and he was making around $45,000 a month. So Jordan shares with us his journey, what he learned along the way, and in hindsight, what he could have done better. I hope you enjoy today's conversation. If you have any questions or any comments, feel free to leave them in the comments section below if you're on YouTube, or feel free to reach out to me at DecafQuest on Twitter. If you want to keep up to date with future episodes, make sure to click on the subscribe button. And I want to thank you very much for tuning in and for listening. Jordan, thank you very much for joining me today in the Marketplace Discussions podcast. And just we were discussing several things before we started recording. So I'll just start with asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll jump right into the discussion.
Yeah, so right now I run a few different things. I run Closet Tools, which is an app that automates Poshmark closets. So Poshmark is a website where you can list items for sale. It can be, you know, new or used clothing. You know, you could think of it almost like an eBay, but a little bit of a nuanced twist on it. It's almost like social media in a way, where you have to engage with the platform. You have to share your items to your followers. You can like items. You can, send offers to people. And so because of that engagement aspect, it takes a lot of time. And so I built Closet Tools to automate those things to save Poshmark sellers time. And then ultimately it ends up increasing their sales because it's constantly engaging with customers and, you know, with the platform. So I run that, and I've been running that for over 4 years now. But I've only been on it full time about 2 years. And then also I do SEO consultations, and I do I'm running an SEO course. And that's mostly because Closet Tools, I've always seen it as a very short-term thing. And for some reason it's lasted this long. And so I've constantly always been working in the background trying to come up with, you know, additional streams of income. So I went down that route. It seems to be working out pretty well. I have a lot of expertise there because that's how I built Closet Tools. That's how I marketed Closet Tools. That's how I built my customer base. So I have a lot of credibility there. And so I've tapped into that and, you know, served my audience by, you know, helping them with their own websites, helping them do SEO for themselves. And then through the course, basically what I found was I've done probably upwards of 100 consultations, just smaller consultations, just quick things like, hey, I noticed this. Hey, I noticed that. And through those consultations, I kind of ran into the same things over and over and over again. And so that's why I developed the course, because I was basically giving everybody almost the same advice. So the course kind of automates that, right? Where it's like my advice automated. You can tap into exactly what I probably would say, you know, for anyone. But then it also is a little bit of a twist because it gives a little bit of my philosophy and my opinion as to how you should approach SEO and things like that. So yeah, that's what I'm currently doing now. I probably won't be doing either of these things in 5 years. So we'll see. We'll see what the long term looks like.
Failed the interview question, man. I'm sorry, I'm not going to hire you anymore. You don't know what you're going to be doing in the next five years. Right? That's
it. Yeah.
We're sorry, but we're not going to go through with the hiring. But yeah, I'm this not is. The...
I'm not the stable, reliable guy that you were looking for in your corporation.
Unfortunately, yeah, especially set by the unemployable guy here who's...
Yeah.
Have you... Before I ask you about Closet Tools and about your other ventures, have you been... And you kind of hinted at it, but have you been in a 9-to-5 job before?
Yeah, so for a while I was. I graduated from high school in 2010, and then I did a 4-year bachelor's at RIT, which is a technical school in New York, and I graduated as an electrical engineer. So I actually worked for Corning Incorporated, which, is, you know, like you think like Gorilla Glass and, you know, they have a bunch of different products. I didn't work on Gorilla Glass. I worked in a different department. But yeah, I actually worked for Corning for about 7 years. And I honestly, so, you know, I'm probably jumping the gun a little bit, but I think that experience served me so well in my ability to be able to produce a product like Closet Tools. Specifically around, you know, automating things. Basically what I was doing at Corning was glorified robotics. I say glorified robotics because I wasn't building robots, but I was building testing modules for laser optics and for optical lenses. So they would drop in a lens and then I would be pushing lasers through it to test the quality of the lens. And so I'd have sensors and things on the other end that were collecting data and you'd move it around and you'd, you know, get all these different perspectives of the lens and you're, you know, collecting, automating, doing things over time. And so it basically was like a robot, right? Like, so it's got motors, it's got sensors, it's moving, but it obviously wasn't like, it's not like what you think of a traditional robot, you know, walking around kind of thing. So yeah, that's what I was doing. And so what was really awesome about that, and what I think is really awesome about having a traditional job is, number one, that specific job was really great because I was only working for Corning. So like, you know, they obviously are producing products for customers, right? Customers are buying these lenses, they're buying these optical lenses. And so certain engineers had to deal with the customers. And there was all these red tape, paperwork, you know, you got to test everything, you got to document everything, you got to, you know, you got to sign all these things, you got to swear by these things that you're going to do this, yada, yada. Whereas for me, I was just testing stuff. So I could just whip something up and I didn't have to write anything. I did write documentation so like other people could use it, but it was really cool because I could just kind of hack constantly. I could iterate, I could improve, I could just work fast. I didn't have to deal with any of that stuff. So there was that aspect. But I think one thing that I really miss about the traditional 9-to-5 was the access to technology. You know, like on a daily basis, I was interacting with, you know, lasers that would cost upwards of, you know, $2 to $5 million if you really wanted to purchase a laser, right? And so, you know, as an indie hacker, as a solopreneur, I will never achieve a level where I could actually have a, you know, that type of infrastructure to do that level of technology. And so, so I miss that, right? Because it's really cool interacting with really high advanced technology, you know, even things that are, you know, government regulated, right? Like, you know, I probably couldn't even talk to you about some of the projects that I worked on, right? Because, you know, this is foreign interests and stuff like that, right? So that's really cool. But like, you know, I don't get that. Like Closet Tools is such a small thing, you know, technologically wise compared to that. So I love the freedom of being a solopreneur. I love that, you know, my kids are young. I'm able to stay home, you know, work from home. I can interact with them all day and, you know, impact their lives. But I do miss that just core technology, that ability to really, you know, interact with really cool stuff. So I worked for Corning for about 7 years. And then what happened was, and this is the story that, you know, you were alluding to earlier, I got to a point where, so I went to RIT and it was a pretty expensive school. It was about 40-50K a year. You know, for tuition. It was a private school. So I had racked up a lot of student loans. I had racked up, you know, 150K to 200K in student loans. And it's interesting because it's hard to give advice in regards to college because when I went to college, I actually grew up in a really small farm town. I grew up, you know, just, it was about like 1,000 people, just, you know, there's probably more cows than people where I grew up. And so when I went to RIT, I was so green. I knew I was interested in technology, but I had no real concept of what technology was. And, you know, what, you know, I had played around with computers, did a little stuff. I never had coded anything. I never was a programmer or anything like that. And so at RIT, I was exposed to all of these different things. I took artificial intelligence classes. I watched people, you know, code things and develop things. And I was like, man, that's something I'm really interested in. I'm going to dive into that. And so if I hadn't had that experience, then I wouldn't have gone down any of those paths. And so, like, was it worth the $200K to do that? I don't know. I don't think it was worth it from the perspective of the job that I got. You know, so the job that I got, you know, I was started out maybe at around like 60K. And then after, you know, 3 or 4 years, it worked its way up to about 80K a year. But, you know, after taxes, I live in New York. So, you know, you have the extra state tax and stuff like that. You know, after taxes, my gross income was like, you know, $4,000 a month, $4,500 a month, maybe. And my student loans were like $2,000 a month. You know, that's like the minimum, right? That would be like for the next 30 years, I'd be paying that. And then, you know, so there's that, right? So at a minimum, just me and then me and my wife, I had got married right around the time I got fully hired on at Corning. So at a minimum, we were basically poor, right? We had like, you know, $2,000 of, you know, money for groceries, clothes, you know, just like essentials, right? And so we, you know, out of necessity, we started racking up a little bit of credit card debt just to kind of survive. You know, we lived very minimally, had a really cheap apartment, just really, you know, pretty low level. And then we find out we're having a kid. So, so for me personally, this was a little intimidating because I'm like, we're already not really making it, right? Like, this is not sustainable for us. Now we're going to put a kid in the picture. And so I had a little bit of a switch flip in me where I was like, you know what, like you have to do something about this because if this is going to work long term, like, you know, then you need to be making a lot more money. You know, you need to be have more control over your time and things like that. And so my first approach was to just go to Corning and be like, hey, I want to, you know, work harder, maybe work more hours. You know, I want to make more money. How can I do that? And at that specific time, there was a little bit of a market decline for the advanced optics. And they were like, sorry, we can't really do that. You know, we're already on a hiring freeze. We can't just guarantee that we're going to increase your salary and stuff like that. And so that was when I decided, okay, you know, I got to figure out how to do something on my own. And it was right around that time I was introduced to Indie Hackers, so indiehackers.com. And also I was starting to read stuff on Hacker News. So I was a little bit in that space and I had this concept of, hey, there's people that, you know, make apps and sell things on the internet. And one of my biggest inspirations at the time was Casey Neistat. I don't know if you know Casey Neistat on YouTube.
He's a YouTuber, no?
Yeah. So he was doing his daily vlog at that time.
Exactly. And
that was his big thing, was, you know, preaching about, you know, hard work and also just, you know, creating things, producing things, you know, like, you know, providing value for people and, you know, just, you know, making things. And so I kind of had this storm of pressure to make more money, to you know, get control of your future, to, you know, actually, you know, move forward in life. And then also I was consuming a lot of things that were telling me, hey, this is a way that you can do that. And so that's when I was like, you know what, I'm going to go all in, I'm going to do this. And so I started out learning how to make websites. I knew how to code, so I would make apps, you know, like robotic style apps for Corning. But I didn't know how to make websites or anything like that. So my first venture was learning how to make websites. Once I figured out how to make websites, I learned HTML, CSS, a little bit of JavaScript. Then I started a web design agency. I was like, you know what? I can make websites. I can just sell them for cheap and I'll make websites. And that failed miserably. number one, because I was terrible at making websites. But number two, what I ran into was when I told people, hey, I can make you a website, they're like, cool, make me a website. And I would make it. And then they would have all these critiques and things. That, you know, like, oh, change this, do this. And I'm just like, you know what? Like, I made the thing, you know, like, I think this is actually a better way of doing it. Like, we should do it this way. So I didn't really like that.
On the side, it was this on the side? Was this a...
Yes, right. So I was still at Corning. So you still had your... Yes. Yep. So I was still at Corning. And it was at this point, I started waking up earlier. I should have mentioned that. So what I did was traditionally I would get up at like, you know, 7, 8 a.m., you know, I'd commute a half hour to work, you know, just, and then do my day and then go home and, you know, whatever. But then I over the course of a month or so, I progressively got up earlier and earlier until I was getting up at 4:30 or 5 a.m. every day. And then what I would do is first thing, I would start making stuff. I would start making websites. I'd start practicing. I would start, you know, just, you know, learning how to do this code. I would learn how to do different things. And so every morning for 2 hours, it was my focus time to, you know, learn something or create something or do that side work or something like that. And so what I went through was a progressive journey of learning all of these different skills and then figuring out what I like to do and what I didn't like to do, or what I, you know, the approach that I wanted to take or the approach that I didn't want to take. And so from there, I had kind of already determined that I wanted to make an app, but I had no idea how to do that. And I also had no ideas for an app to make. And so, I knew I needed to learn some different skills. I knew I needed to learn marketing. And that was mostly because of Hacker News. I found out that I needed to learn marketing because a lot of people would say, hey, making an app is the easy part. You know, the marketing is really the hard part, you know, getting customers. So I was like, okay, I got to...
your product.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew I needed to learn some sort of marketing. And so I decided that SEO was a really good fit because I really like to write. I was already doing writing at the time. I was daily blogging, you know, what I was working on and stuff like that. And so I maxed out a credit card on an SEO course because I was, you know, I was broke. I didn't have money for that. But I knew that was something that was essential to what I was going to be doing in the future. Took the course. Learned a lot. It was really great. Actually, very excellent course. It's kind of like the RIT thing, right? Like, was it worth 200K? Was it worth me maxing out a credit card on it? I mean, today I think it's worth it, but at the moment that would have been a very stupid decision, right? So I think that's kind of my whole life.
Things could in hindsight, it's always easier, right? It's
yeah.
Like, oh yeah, it was a good investment. Well, because it turned out to be a happy ending so far. So yeah.
So far, yeah. So I think. Well, this is straying from the story a little bit, but I think a little bit of it is it's that betting on yourself thing. And I think those types of purchases are like that, right? Like going to expensive private school, you know, paying for these expensive courses, learning these skills, you know, you're bettering yourself, you're betting on yourself. And so you are acquiring things along the way. And I think at that time, I knew I had the right intuition and the right mindset to take that set of skills and apply it and, you know, build something that made money. You know, I think if I was just flippantly, you know, like, oh, I'll take a course and then I'll start working hard, that would have probably worked out really badly. But I had already set up this framework where I was getting up early, I was working hard, I was making things, I was providing value for people. Now there was this next step where it's like, okay, I got to figure out this marketing piece, because if I don't get the marketing piece, then this whole product thing is not going to work out. So I think that was a little bit of my justification, but it's still a stupid decision, right?
So there are two kinds of mindsets when it comes to courses and, you know, sharpening your skills and the kind of narrative that one tells oneself. So based on what I see on Twitter and based on my personal experience as well, right? So sometimes you feel like you want to do something and then, but you don't do anything. And then you start taking one course after the other and signing up for this and that because mm-hmm. you think like you're acquiring the necessary skills to start building something, but then you're postponing the actual building process. In your case, it looks like you had started already and then you figured out that this piece of the puzzle was missing and you tried to, you know, create that. And
yep, exactly. Yeah. I know I picked up that from something I was consuming, but just the fact that you had to make things first, right? Like you start making things and then the learning comes. Like that leads you on that learning journey. You know, rather than you just consuming a bunch of things and never actually making anything. And yeah. So for some reason I understood that that feedback loop was important, and that, you know, like just iterating on something and moving in a direction was more important than just, you know, learning things. So from there, right. So I kind of did this thing, in a few, actually three or four different parts. Actually, there's four different things that I did. So I did the websites. So I learned web development, made the websites. It was terrible making websites for people. So I was like, you know what? Scratch that. I'm not going to do a website, web design agency. Number two, learned SEO, took the course. Then I was like, you know what? Hey, I could start an SEO agency, right? I can do content writing. I can do keyword research. I can help these people out. Started doing that. And what I ran into was, it was great, but I figured out how much value I was providing for people, you know, just like absurd amounts of value. If I was actually to fulfill all of these requests and write all this content and rank for these keywords, I mean, just hundreds of thousands of dollars of value for some businesses. And I'm like, why am I trading this for peanuts when I could just do this for myself, right? Like, I need a project where I can make something and just do this for myself, because this is really valuable and it works really well. So that was when I scrapped that. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to focus on myself and focus on building something that I can do SEO around. And so then the third thing, my wife at the time and still is an artist. She does watercoloring, she does hand lettering, things like that. And one thing that I noticed was that sometimes she would do art on black paper, and she would use, you know, white markers and really, you know, like colorful markers, and it looked really cool. And what I noticed was in the art market that a lot of these artists had really nice fancy journals, you know, like they have the journals, they flip the pages, really nice high quality paper, you know, like sketchbooks and stuff like that. But I noticed there was no notebooks that have black paper. All of the black paper sources were like these, you know, ring bound things that were just ugly, and just, or you could buy like a stack of black paper, right? But there was no like moleskin with black paper. And so I was like, hey, I'm going to make this, right? I'm going to figure out how to make this product, and then I'm going to figure out how to sell it. I'm going to do the SEO for it. I'm going to get a Kickstarter going, get it funded, you know, and make a physical product. And so I did that. And so once again, I spent probably another like $1,000 to $2,000 on Facebook ads. I had, before that, I had reached out to manufacturers on Alibaba. I got samples in. I had a notebook. It looked really good. It was great. And so I was like ready to go. I was running the Facebook ads. I did the Kickstarter. I needed about $15,000 to run the first, you know, set of like 1,000 notebooks to get it shipped over. And I made like 12,000 from that Kickstarter. And so it failed. It ultimately failed. So I didn't, you know, nothing transpired of it. But what I kind of figured out during that time was that I did really like the coding, the art of coding. You know, I really like spending time developing things, developing apps, developing coding. But then the other thing I realized was that you need money to make a physical product. Like, and I had no money, right? And so I realized, like, I need to do something that's free. I need to do something that starts out as free. And code is free, writing is free, right? So I had to double down on those strengths and restrict myself to something that I could produce for $0 and create value for other people so that I could actually build something, you know, for myself, and without requiring any upfront costs, without requiring anything like that. So that was number three. And then, so number four was, okay, now I've figured out I like making websites. I like coding, but I don't like doing that for other people. I love doing SEO, but it's way too valuable to be doing for other people. I should be doing it for myself. I can successfully make a product. I can successfully market a product. And if I had more money and, you know, more time, you know, I probably would have been able to do the black paper notebook thing better. But it didn't work out. But I also figured out I needed that upfront capital to do that. So I needed to focus on code, not physical products. All right. So now I'm at the point where I go back to the beginning where I know that I need to develop an app. And so at this point, I'm dirt poor, right? I've spent all my money. I've, you know, pulled every string that I could. And so my wife is selling on Poshmark. Actually, no, one second. Before this, before I did that, I had a buddy who ran a trucking like a freight management business. So basically they would hire on drivers and they would manage them and they would tell them where to go, where to pick up something, where to drop off something. And they would basically just take a percentage of whatever their revenue was. And so he was, at the time, he was using, you know, like Excel spreadsheets and all these different things to manage the business. And he was like, can you make an app that automates these different things? And at the time, I knew I needed to make an app. And so I was like, oh, this is a perfect opportunity to practice the skills of making an application. So I did that. You know, I learned how to do authentication. I learned how to use a, you know, a database, you know, having a backend. I learned how to integrate the front end with the backend, how to pull data, how to push data, and all of that stuff. And so I did it. I made the app for him. It took me about 6 months. And I did it totally for free because I knew I was just practicing. I was like, you know what? I'm going to charge you $0 because there's no expectations here, right? I don't want you to think that this thing's going to be perfect, but I'm going to try my hardest. I'm going to make it good and I'm going to make it work. And so I did that and I made it work. And so now I had the app skill. I could make an app. I could make an app. I knew how to market it. I knew how to, you know, like do the copywriting and do advertising and all of that stuff. So I had all the skills. I had them all. It took me 2 years to acquire them all. And so then I get to the point where, like I said, I'm dirt poor, just nothing's going right. And then my wife's selling clothes on Poshmark to make extra money because we, at that time, we had two kids and, you know, they were growing out of clothes and things like that. And it's like, oh, we don't need this anymore. We'll sell it, you know, for 20 bucks, 30 bucks or whatever. And so she was doing pretty well on there. But then that was when I realized, hey, you're spending a lot of time on this platform. Like you have to sit down for a few hours a day and actually do all this stuff. And I was like, you know, I know how to, you know, script up stuff. I can just script up something that just like pushes the buttons on the page in order and it'll automate all this for you. And she was like, okay, sounds good. And so I built that. And I built it as a bookmarklet, which is basically like, if you have a bookmark in your browser, you can actually embed JavaScript code in that. So when you click it, it runs the code. And so that's all it was. It just copied and pasted the code into that bookmark. You click the bookmark and it would run through all of your items and it would share them to your followers. And this was great. It was actually helping her make more sales. And then her friends heard about it because her friends were also selling on Poshmark. And that was how my wife had heard about it. And so they all wanted it. And they were like, wow, this thing is great. I just push this button and it, you know, saves me like an hour. That's really cool. And so at the time, I didn't really think anything of it in terms of turning it into a business or anything like that. I just made it to be helpful. And, you know, just one more thing to practice, one more thing to just kind of, you know, add to the skill set. But at that time, I was doing blogging on my website, and I actually blogged about this bookmarklet. Like, hey, just copy and paste this code, make a bookmark, it'll run this for you. And after about 2 or 3 months, that blog post started ranking for Poshmark-related keywords. And then I started getting emails from people saying, hey, I found this blog article, you made this script, it's really cool, I don't really know how to use it, can you tell me how to use it? Or like, hey, if you come up with other stuff, let me know, you know, like, because this would be really useful. And so it was another 3 months or so, and maybe a dozen emails later before I realized, oh, wait, this is like, people are demanding this thing. They want this thing. I think I can actually turn this into a business. I can actually make an app out of this. And so that's how it started. So then what I did was I took, you know, the couple of emails that I got told them I was going to make the app. And what I did was I bundled that bookmarklet that I had originally had on my blog. I bundled it up behind an email list sign up. So basically you sign up for, you put your email address in, I'll send you the code and then you can set it up. And it was all free. And so I posted that on the Poshmark subreddit. So I went to Reddit and, you know, it's thousands of users or whatever. And I said, hey, this is free. You just put in your email. It's just a script that you click it and it shares all your items, saves you a bunch of time. Here it is for free. And from that post, I got about 200 emails from people that were interested in this tool. And so I was like, cool, this is great. Like, this is working. And so basically what I had asked them was, basically what I'm going to do is over the next month, I'm going to build this app. I'm going to make a front end for it, you know, where you can click buttons, you can change settings and stuff. And then all I want is for you to give feedback back from the tool. I'll give it to you for free. Like, you just give me feedback so that I can, you know, make this thing better and make it useful for you. And so that's what I did. And so the part of app development that I didn't fully understand and I'd ever had practiced was billing. And you know, like subscription management. So when somebody signs up for your app, they actually have to pay you. And like, you know, if their payment fails, then you restrict access in the app and things like that. And I had no idea how any of that works. So I spent 3 weeks of the 1 month that I was building the tool trying to figure out Stripe billing. And that was actually where Indie Hackers was really indispensable, because I posted a post on there and somebody helped me right away just figure out how Stripe works, how webhooks work, you know, how to integrate that with my app and things. So it was great. So after a month, I developed a front end. It was just this little pop-up that would pop up on the page. And so it was still the bookmarklet. You would still click the bookmarklet, but this thing would pop up and then you'd have buttons and you had settings and you could actually like interact with it. From there, I asked for feedback from people. They gave me feedback. I added a few more features over the next week or two. And then I launched it. I sent out to the email list. I said, it's ready. You know, it's $30 a month. You could start a free trial right now. And so from that initial email, I got 10 customers. So I was at, $300, you know, monthly from that email. And then, from there, I consistently used Reddit as a marketing channel, until they kicked me off because they didn't like me promoting my own stuff all the time. So I kind of was like really high on Reddit, but then I knew all these SEO skills. So I had started writing content. So I was producing content basically weekly, just pushing out articles because I knew I was going to rank for these terms. And so as the Reddit thing started fading down, my SEO started taking off. And from there, it just started growing. And then it grew for, you know, the next 2 years or so. The pandemic really helped because people were quitting their jobs and because, you know, they didn't want to go into work and stuff like that. And so they still wanted to make extra money. So they started selling on Poshmark and then they found out about my tool. And so that actually was when it spiked up to its highest point. And that was when I did like the Indie Hackers interview and stuff like that. And it was a real high point for the app. So here's something that I've found out recently in hindsight that I think I would have done very differently. So I always treated Closet Tools as a short-term thing. Like I know, like even when I first started, I was like, I cannot bet my whole life on this thing. Like, right, I'm not going to work on this thing for the next 40 years, right? I'm not going to build a retirement off of this thing, right? So I approached it very hesitantly. And especially because it's built on somebody else's platform, right? Like Poshmark could change one thing and boom, it's gone, right? Like I was very hesitant to bet the farm on it. But looking back in hindsight, that was a really bad decision because what I should have done is I should have went a lot harder on it and really bet on it and spent 100% of my time on it, 100% of my effort on it. And I should have built it up to a point where I had an exit window where it was a great return. You know, maybe I make $1 million, $2 million, something like that, and exit, sell the company, you know, to somebody else. They can grow it, they can manage it. You know, they could put some employees behind it. Whereas for me, I took it way more hesitantly and I grew it slowly and I, just really didn't work on it 100% with like all of my effort, with all of my energy. I kind of was constantly working on other things that I should, you know, I was like, oh, I need more streams of income because this thing could go away at any moment. I need more streams of income. So I kind of regret that because I think what I could have done is I could, at that peak, I could have sold it for two, maybe even $3 million. I was making, $45,000 a month, with the tool. It was after 2 years of growth.
That's quite decent.
Yeah. So, you know, I could have sold it for a really good amount, but I didn't have that perspective. My perspective was like, okay, this is great. This is great income. This is cool, but I need to be building something else, right? I wasn't prepared to.
This is, I think, very interesting what your reflection basically here, because on the one hand, your dilemma is, should have I gotten all in and then exited mm-hmm. as soon as possible, or should I have continued doing or increasing my income streams right. with small bets? And you mm-hmm. are a member of Small Bets, Daniel Vassallo's yep. community, right? So mm-hmm. this is probably, I know you already did some reflection, but do you think, Like, which one is better long term? I understand on the one hand you might have gotten, you know, 1-2 million if you just focused all your energy on building this platform and then sold it to someone else. But don't you think you were able to maybe increase not only your income streams, but develop more skills on the side because you always had this fear in the back of your mind, and you're like, at any point in time, just like having a full-time job, something might happen, and then maybe I might lose this application, and so you were trying to create other things. Didn't this help as well, if in hindsight?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it helps. You're right, from a skill perspective and things like that. But from a financial perspective, I don't think it helped, right? And so, you know, that's kind of, you know, what Daniel talks about. It's not really financial optimization, it's risk aversion, right? And so I think I biased too much for risk aversion. And I think if I would have biased for financial optimization, and if I had the mindset of, okay, you can sell this and have a liquidation event, and this will set you up for a future where you can, you know, pretty much do whatever you want. You know, this gives you several years of runway. You know, you can, you know, set up a little bit for retirement kind of thing. But I didn't have that perspective. I was too much on the risk management side because this was my first entrepreneurial journey. I had no idea what I was doing. I was very scared that Poshmark could turn this thing off at any moment. And so it was a little bit of a fear-based decision. It wasn't a faith-based decision. And that's something that has, I think, bit me in the past. Is anytime I've made decisions out of fear, it usually ends up being the wrong decision. And so that's not to say that you shouldn't do the small bets. I think the small bets is approach. I mean, that's what I did all the way up until I had Closet Tools, right? I did the web design agency. I did the SEO agency. I did the small physical product. I did the app, right? Those were all small bets that led me to acquiring great skills, that led me to figuring out what I liked to do, what I didn't like to do, what I was naturally good at, what I was naturally bad at, you know, what I had energy for, what drained my energy, right? I figured all those things out. But Closet Tools was, at least, you know, at first and still today, it's kind of the epitome of everything that I'm really good at. It's based on SEO. So I just write stuff and I get, you know, traffic to my website. I get to code all the time. I get to interact with, you know, people. I get to help people. You know, it's something that I just naturally like to do, is help people. And so I think once you figure those things out, I do think you should double down on that thing, right? Like, this thing was working, right? It's growing. It's everything that I'm really good at. I think it's good to take a step back and be like, wait a minute, this is actually a very good thing and I should focus on this. And I don't think you should always approach everything from such a risk standpoint that, like, okay, you know, like, this could go away at any moment. And so, a little bit of a reflection. But the small bets approach, but I mean, that's what I've been doing on the side, right? At one point I did a project called Quant Secrets that was, quantitative, investing, project, automated quantitative investing, project. And I was looking specifically at, like, crypto and stuff like that. That didn't really work out. It just drained my energy. I wasn't really interested in it. I thought I was interested in it because I needed to make a bunch of money, but it just didn't really work out. I'm trying to think. I feel like I've done a few other things. Lately I've been doing the SEO thing. I think for me personally, I do think once you acquire those skills and once you really know who you are, what you're good at, what is naturally valuable, you know, like what people exchange money for, I think you can really bet on something, and you can take that bet and go with it. And for me personally, the other thing that I've realized is that, you know, individuals are very limited. And so there is a peak, it's very rare for a solopreneur, an individual, to be making more than $1 million a year, right? That's extremely rare. Even as a CEO of a company, only the top maybe 50 or 100 CEOs in the world are making more than $1 million a year, you know, as a salary. I mean, obviously they get, you know, investments and, you know, they're invested in the companies and shares in the company and stuff like that. But as terms of a salary, people pay, you know, you getting money in your bank account, very rare that you're making more than $1 million a year. And so when I was making $500,000 a year, I should have realized, wait a minute, this is almost the limit, right, of what I can handle. I either need to hire people or I need to exit. And so I didn't do either, right? And so I hit that limit and it plateaued because I can't handle more than this, right? I can't grow higher than this. It just isn't physically possible for me to keep up. And so, you know, the app, you know, starts to lag a little bit because I'm doing customer service.
I saw you also tweet a few months back, if I'm not mistaken. You did tweet about the website plateauing and then you were having some difficulty. I don't recall if it was an SEO issue or just, you know, subscriptions were dwindling a bit. I don't know exactly what the problem might have been. Maybe post-pandemic people were not selling. Maybe it was the economy, but yeah, it's...
I think it's a combination of things. I do think it was the SEO a little bit. I wasn't getting enough new customers. I really lost focus because I didn't know if I was supposed to be working on this thing and help, you know, in growing this thing, or if I should be working on something else. And so I kind of was in this really foggy year or so where I'm like, I have all this income coming in from this app. It's starting to go down. So that's even more scary, right? So I'm like, I have to work on something else, right? The moment's over, right? I lost the moment.
Self-fulfilling prophecy kind of. You're like, this exactly. is going to go uh-huh. bust. Well, I am going bust, yeah.
Yep, yeah. The fear took over and I didn't pull my trigger. And yeah, so... it's a very big learning moment for me, and 100% everything that I build from here on out, unless it's a very personal venture, you know, like my personal website or something like that, is built to sell, right? It should be built to pull the trigger and within, you know, a month's notice, it should be sellable to an entity. It should be packaged well. It should be managed well, you know, tax wise and all that stuff. Right. Because I do think that, like I said, as an individual, you're very limited, and you can't just grow infinitely as an individual. And so, yeah, you either hit a moment where you have to hire or you need to sell. And so going forward, that's what I want to do.
Can't you, for example, reconsider selling now? Or is that an option?
Yes. So what happened was I hit this peak and it starts going down, right? And that dramatically reduces the valuation of a business. If your business isn't growing, it's worth so much less. When it was growing, I was growing at a rate, you know, I don't know, like 10% a month, 20% a month, something like that, right? That makes the business worth, you know, 2 to 5 times the annual revenue, right? But if it's not growing, it's only worth like maybe 1x the annual revenue. And so now my selling point was gone, right? Because if I sold it, I'm going to sell this, you know, I'm making, you know, $300,000 a year, $400,000 a year, and I'm going to only be able to sell it for $400,000. Whereas literally 5 months ago, I could have sold it for $2 million. And so I'm not going to sell it now. I know it's worth more than that, but at the same time, it's not growing, so I can't sell it. So it really just was this really downward thing where it's like, oh, now I'm stuck with this thing, right? Like I have to work on this thing. I can't sell it because I'm not going to make what I need from it. You know, like $400,000 is nice, but like that's what I make in a year. So why would I not just keep it and make that in a year?
Is it the subscription model as well? Because people like, you know, Daniel and I've seen others on Twitter debating whether the subscription model is effective.
Yeah,
people. I even saw an article the other day I forgot where, but something along the lines of people are getting tired from the subscription model. You're subscribed to so many things, etc., etc. Have you maybe considered if it's the subscription in addition to all the other factors, and maybe switching it to a?
So my perspective on that. Thing? Yeah, my perspective on that is two things. I think. Number one, as a default, if your app requires some amount of money to maintain, right? Like per customer, it costs me a few dollars a month per customer, right? You can't accurately estimate an upfront cost that would, you know, because what if they're around for 10 years, right? They paid $300 and they're around for 10 years. They've now charged me, you know, $3,000 in services that I've provided to them. But yet they've had value provided to them for 10 years. Right. And so, so I think that's number one. And so that's what, you know, like most SaaS apps fall under. They actually have some amount of cost. You have servers, you have different services that you tap into every month you're paying for. And so there is some amount of money you need per month per customer, because if it ran off infinitely, then you didn't make enough money. Whereas, right, for other things that have zero cost, you're right, you're talking like digital courses, you're talking, you know, anything that just has one upfront cost, or even code, like apps that are like desktop apps where it doesn't, it runs all on your computer. It's not running on server infrastructure that, you know, costs money and things like that. Like you can just ship an app, they download it from the app store. It doesn't cost you a dime. That type of stuff, I don't think requires a subscription. And I think you will do better off if you just get that $20, get that $50 right out of the bat, because people are more apt to pay a higher dollar amount now than signing up for a subscription where it's like, oh, I'm going to be paying $10 a month, $20 a month for the rest of my life for this. I don't think so. And that's what happened with Adobe, you know, with Photoshop and stuff, right? Like people knew you pay once, you get the app, good to go, right? Doesn't cost Adobe anything. I just use the app and it's great. But then they switched to the subscription model and people are like, wait a minute, like I just had this thing for a fixed cost, you know, for me, like one-time cost, and now I got to pay monthly for it. But you know, Adobe introduced all of their services. You can upload your images to the Adobe cloud and all of this stuff, right? So they have server infrastructure that costs money. So they needed to charge monthly, because if you, like I said, if you run out to infinity, you can't charge enough upfront to justify what that actual cost is going to be long-term. So SaaS is a little bit of a mixed thing in regards to that. You know, there's other people that make tools where, you know, it's just a front end, right? Where like you made a website and then, the user puts in their own API keys, you know, they can tap into their own, you know, they're spending money, like you see like all the GPT wrappers today where like you put in your, OpenAI key. And so you're still paying OpenAI, but the cost for that person who made that front end is zero because they're not paying that OpenAI, you know, subscription for you. Whereas other apps, other AI apps are paying that subscription for you. You don't put in your key. And so there is a cost to you using the app. And so then they do need to bill you monthly because there are actual costs monthly for you using the app. So yeah, it's not a one size fits all. You can't just charge one fee for things that are going to exist long term, unless, like I said, it's a fixed thing where it doesn't cost you any money. You know, I mean, you could think of it like a physical product, right? Like if I send you a notebook, you know, you pay me $20 for it, right? It doesn't cost me $1 a month for you to use that notebook, right? Like it doesn't cost me anything. I shipped it to you, you use it, that's it, right? You know, whereas if there was something on that notebook, you know, that cost me money every month, I couldn't sell it to you for $20. I'd have to sell it to you for at least a little bit more than what it cost me per month, you know, to give that notebook to you. So I don't know. It is the pricing thing has always been interesting. I had several competitors that undercut me, but they were always, I don't know, not very good apps and stuff like that. So, I think the pricing was actually very right. And that's actually, I think, why it did really well. I think it was really good and unique, and I think it did well. But I think the pricing was actually really pretty spot on for the value it provided. So I got to this moment, right, where I can't sell it. It's declining. I have no backup. I don't know what I'm supposed to be working on. I'm not focused.
That's curious, because you said you were working on several other things, or at least trying to work on several other things. But then when kind of shit hit the fan, you did not actually have a backup. So,
right. I didn't actually have a backup plan. Right. Right.
Ouch.
I was trying to build the backup plan, but didn't actually have a backup.
Also, for clarification, you had, I think, 2 years in, you decided to pursue this full time. And so you.
Right. Yeah. So I quit my job. Yep. Yep. Yeah. So I quit my job 2 years in.
Any other kind of
plan
Bs.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the plan B, you know, the worst case scenario, I just go back and get a job.
Yeah, like, right. Yeah, sure.
I have valuable skills. It's not like nobody would hire me, but it certainly wouldn't be as good as if, you know, I was working from home and stuff like that. So I do work really hard to maintain this lifestyle because it is really great. And so there's a lot of benefits to it that I really enjoy. It really works well with my personality and how I do things. So that's what I got to. I got to that point. And that's kind of where I'm at today, except I have been doing different things, and Clauses Tools is actually growing again, and it's doing really well. I actually have some different products that I want to build in that space, and just keep going with it and keep building it. And then I want to kind of get back up to that exit point that I had before, and then pull the trigger on it. You know, if I can sell for, you know, between $1 million, $2 million, you know, I would love to hit that exit point. That would set me up with a few years of, you know, time to be able to build up some other form of income, to be able to, you know, focus on a few different things and figure out where I want to go and, you know, what I want to build and things like that. Yeah, because it still makes quite a bit of money today and it still does really well. And people still email me about how great it is and how much they love it. So it's still a great thing. But for, you know, it's been a really interesting journey learning all of that and, you know, analyzing the hindsight. And I will say one thing that I did, that I think worked out really well was I did a lot of writing through it. And so I have my personal blog, and at least monthly I was publishing something about, you know, what I was learning, ideas I was exploring, you know, failures I was encountering, you know, things I was trying. And I think I was able to process a lot of things throughout that. And so I learned a lot about myself and I learned a lot about the journey. And obviously I didn't learn everything because I would have done things differently maybe in the past. But I think in hindsight, I can look at that writing and I can understand, you know, what I was thinking and I can see the progressive journey. And I think through that writing, it allowed me to think a lot more clearly about things. And so I'm not very confused today about what I need to do. It's mostly I'm so limited and I have limited amount of energy and time. Deciding what to actually focus on that energy on is the thing that I struggle with most, because I have this SEO thing, you know, I have the consultations, yeah, the course. I could focus on that and I could easily, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, I could make 25K to 50K a month doing that. If I focused on it 100%, you know, spent my 8 hours a day on it or whatever, I could do that probably within the next, you know, 6 months or something like that. But I have Clauses Tools. It's still making quite a bit of money. And it doesn't require me to spend my time on it. Whereas like the consultations, you know, it's actually time that takes, you know, it takes me time to actually do those things. I'm basically exchanging my time for money. And so I'm at this point where I am trying to actively grow Clauses Tools to get to this exit point again. And I am actually building up that SEO consultation and course income to be able to have at least some sort of a fallback in case things fall through. But it's a very on off thing. I've set it up in a way where I'm not like bound to like clients and things like that. I can turn it on and push out a tweet and say, "Hey, my services are up. You can pay for them now. People will sign up." Or I can just not say anything and nobody signs up kind of thing. And so, that's where I'm at. So my goal is to by this summer to grow Clauses Tools to somewhat around what that liquidation point was where I had before. The way I'm doing that is through content, through SEO, and then through the new products that I'm launching. So. So that's kind of the plan. But just really, really wild journey, really interesting. And so I think my new philosophy is that, at least for me personally, I always struggle with this idea of like, what am I going to work on for the next 40 years? You know, like what, like I would love to have something that I'm just doing for the next 40 years, because then I can really build, right? Like I can push in a direction and I can, you know, build.
That long term, my God.
Well, I mean, if you really enjoy working on something, you know, like I'm not talking like, you know, I'm a bricklayer and I'm like, I want to work for 40 years, right? Like this is stuff that I would love to be talking about, you know, like even like this podcast, right? Like, this is stuff that I like to do, right? I could do this for the next 40 years. It'd be a lot of fun, right? And so if I could find a way to make an income doing that, that's cool, right? I don't feel the need to retire from talking with people, right? Oh, like, yeah. That's not, right? So if I have a direction where I'm like, bam, like, I just move in this direction and eventually it works out, I make money and I can just do it forever, perfect. But I think what works better for me, what helps me, is a little bit more of a short-term thing, where the long-term thing is building businesses and coding things and helping people. But the short-term thing is you're going to work on this thing as hard as you can for a year or two, and you're going to sell it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's my long-term plan, is to build and sell consecutively. Because that allows me to have something to focus on and really hyper focus on and iterate on and build on. But then when I get to 4 or 5, I'm not getting to that 4 or 5 year window where I'm like in this cloudy point where I'm like, should I sell it? Should I not sell it? I don't know. And so I think that's what I'm going to do for the next, 10 to 20 years is do that consecutively.
This is kind of where things become a little bit complicated in the sense that it's very difficult to generate new ideas to mm-hmm. build something and know that for sure it might or might not work. So that's also taking or making a bet in this case. And so far as, of course, well, so many scenarios there. Mm-hmm. Let's say you sell closet tools and then you work on something for 1 or 2 years, but then it might be a complete failure. But yeah, this might be quite tricky as well, but I understand where you're coming from. And then you figured that out so far, but when it comes to closet tools, you had a problem, your wife had a problem, and mm-hmm. then you jumped in and you're like, yeah, let me try to solve this problem. And then it picked up and it became a business.
Yep.
See, this is the thing, is it's easier to have or to think, okay, I'm gonna build new stuff. And I think this happens a lot with indie hackers or solopreneurs or whatever. They're like, yeah, I wanna build, I wanna solve a problem, etc. But then you come to a point whereby you think to yourself, okay, I wanna build, but what problem am I trying to solve? Mm-hmm. So one approach is that of Peter Askew, for example. He looks for expired domains for inspiration and then builds a business around that.
Yep.
For you, is there some sort of algorithm or method or process that you go through in order to think about something to build or a problem to solve?
I think for me, I think a lot of it drives mostly from my interests, but also it's kind of solving my own problems, which it can go both ways, right? Because some people, if they think their problems are bigger than they actually are, and they think that the solution is more valuable than it actually is. So I don't know, I don't really have a really strict framework around that. Even with the whole journey to this point, it was mostly just helping other people, and just somebody else had a problem, I knew how to fix it, right? If you really think about, if I follow that pattern, what's going to happen is in 6 months or a year, somebody that I know personally is going to have a problem, and they're gonna say, like, man, like, I wish there was something that fixed this. And I'm gonna be like, hey, I know a guy, it's me, I could fix that, right? And then I'm gonna start a business around that. I don't know. You never really know. But I think that's where the small bets approach really works. I would never spend 2 years building something without it working, right? Like, the closet tools thing was literally 1 month. I went from zero to, $400 or $500 a month in revenue, right? So I probably maximum would spend 3 months on an idea, on an MVP, something that I could build, something that I could market a little bit, and something that I could, ship to somebody and say, like, hey, there's this thing, it's valuable, it saves this much time, it saves you this much money, or makes you this much money. So that's where the small bets approach is really handy. Whereas I think that's what a lot of people run into, is they do the small bets approach, but then they hang on to things, right? They don't shut down things. They don't admit that this is a failure and you need to stop and you need to try something else.
Deep down, they have this hope that it will be a hit maybe at one point in the future, and then they get stuck in this vicious circle. You know, just like when you're literally betting, you're like, you lose the first bet, second bet, third bet. You're like, next time they're going to win and you keep losing.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that Quant Secrets project, I was talking about it on Twitter. I was doing live streams. I would do a daily live stream where I would work on it for an hour. You could just watch me work. People really liked it. They thought it was cool. But 2 months in, 3 months in, I found that I was dreading it, that I had no energy for it, that when I, you know, it just wasn't clicking right, and I axed it. And I mean, it was disappointing because I had to admit to my audience, like, okay, I'm not actually going to go forward with this. Like, it's you know, because people were expecting me to build this thing, and they were like, oh yeah, if you build that, I'll use it, right? And so, yeah, I think. And that's where, you know, Daniel's idea of, you know, treating your projects like cattle and not pets is really important, because if you treat it like a pet, then you can't get rid of it, right? Like, you have to take care of this thing, you know, like, otherwise it's morally unethical to not take care of this thing. Whereas if you treat it like cattle, you know, it's raised for a purpose and you slaughter it and you eat it and you eat whatever comes out at the end. It's a lot easier to justify canceling something, quitting something, and moving forward. And so, that's the approach. And so what, you know, the reason why I want to build up Closet Tools right now is because it's already at a point where it's really valuable, makes a lot of money. It's in a market that's doing well, and I have the skills to grow it. But the exit liquidity will provide me that time frame for me to actually focus all of my energy on a small bet that can grow into something. Whereas right now I'm still double dipping. I'm still working on Closet Tools, still working on side stuff. And for me and my energy and the way that I do things, it just doesn't really work that well. I have a really hard time context switching between different things, different projects, you know, doing, you know, coding here and writing here. You know, like for me, it's like, I want to sit down in one day and I want to code for 4 hours, you know, or I want to sit down one day and I want to write a blog post from start to finish in 4 hours. That works a lot better for me because, I don't know, for me personally, I'm a thinker. I do a lot of subconscious processing. And so throughout, you know, 24 hours, I'm constantly thinking, and then usually something will click and I'm like, boom, I got to execute on this. And so it'll be a feature for an app, or it'll be a blog post or something like that. And I just want to focus 100% of my energy on that. Whereas when I'm juggling multiple things, I can't really do that. I have to maintain this thing. I have to jump over here and do customer support and all that stuff, right? And so what I'm hoping is that exit liquidity provides me with a window where I can take a step back and I can focus all my energy on one thing, something that I'm interested in, something that provides value to people. And that will give me a better chance at turning a small bet into something else that can provide another liquidity event. And then that adds more years of income to my life. And the goal is to, over the next 10, 20 years, to have enough liquidity events that I never have to work again, right? And then I just do stuff for fun, right? And so that's kind of the long-term plan.
Yeah, that, see, I kind of experienced something similar when it comes to producing or creating, because it is draining and exhausting, especially when what you do is all focused on just creating stuff, and creating not in the sense, you know, like not necessarily building stuff, in your case writing code, and then you're writing SEO and copy and stuff like that. In my case, I teach philosophy, so I have to prepare for philosophy courses, and then I teach other things, and then everything revolves in my case around writing and thinking. It gets to a point whereby you cannot do two jobs at the same time in one day. And so you either have to, in your case, focus on coding one day, customer support the other, or writing copy the other day. In my case, if I'm working on two or three different projects, if I'm reading something related to Descartes, and then reading something related to freelancing for the podcast, and then trying to write a newsletter on the, you know, so it's all... you're processing so many ideas and you're trying to come up with something that is coherent. It is exhausting. So I get you. Yeah. And I kind of understand where this is coming from, because at one point you're on the one hand you're either stuck. This is where you currently are. You feel stuck, and then mm-hmm. you're trying to push through. You don't know how to get there, but hopefully things will work out. But yes, it's quite exhausting. Like, you can juggle so many things in a week, but then you cannot. You have to dedicate at least for each thing one day, because otherwise it's gonna be right. Completely chaotic. I flashback to last year. I was completely drained and exhausted. It was mm-hmm. A nightmare, and this is why I stopped the podcast back then. But yeah, and maybe a few kind of just final reflections on the SEO thing, because I saw that you started your SEO as a consultation at first. I think it, as you said, it took a lot of effort. You ended up maybe recording something that you thought would take 30 minutes, would take an hour, 2 hours, et cetera, et cetera. You stopped that. You finished your backlog, and then you shifted things a bit. So what was going on? Like, this is a new venture. Maybe you've learned a few things along the lines, and this is how you ended up doing the course. What's the process like? This is
much like the last 5 years of my life, I knew that there were some things that I needed to learn if I wanted to produce an SEO course that was valuable for people. I knew how to do SEO for myself, and I knew my own perspectives and my own I knew what I do worked for myself. But I needed to do more research into how to do SEO for other markets, how other people do SEO, and you know, basically having a much better holistic perspective of how SEO works across the entire internet. And so, yes, the consultations, you know, I charged money for them. I actually charged very little compared to the value that I was providing for people. But all it was practice. And so, like, even though it was an additional income stream, and then technically I could turn that into an income stream if I really wanted to, you know, do that. But at the end of the day, for me, it was practice. And it was just like all those four or five things that I did before Closet Tools. I needed to practice the skill of SEO for other people so that I could give the correct advice in a course that was meaningful and valuable. And it wasn't just me spouting off my opinions. I had examples and data to back up what I was saying. And so that's what it was. And so, and back in December, I started doing what I call the power half hour, where basically I go through your website for a half hour and, you know, I will give you tips for how to adjust your website. I would do some keyword research and be like, hey, if I was you, I would go in this direction with SEO. And then I would give them a little bit of a blueprint going forward as to, you know, how I would do SEO for their business. What happened in December was I did get too big of a backlog. And what ended up happening was to reduce the amount of time I was spending on them, I would come into the video cold, having not seen anything about their website or knowing anything about their market or anything like that. They would fill out a form, but I would actually read the form during the half hour and be like, oh, like, this is your website, you know, let's go look at it, kind of thing. And so what happened was the feedback was hit or miss. A lot of times what would happen is I would jump down a rabbit hole and be like, oh, like, I see this, I'm going to go down here and just explore here. And then I would just kind of run out of time. And so it was hit or miss. Some people, I went down the right rabbit hole and it was really impactful and very valuable for them. And they're like, wow, this is, you know, really, really great. And other people was like, wait a minute, like, you focused on this one thing, but like, that's not really what I care about or what I'm, you know, what advice I was seeking. Right. And so I had turned that off because I was like, you know what? The model isn't working out. I'm learning a lot. I am seeing a lot of things. I'm gaining a lot of perspectives and I feel like I'm helping people, but the actual service itself, something's broken about it. And so I turned it off, went through the holidays, you know, Christmas, New Year's, and then I turned it back on again. And now the way that I do it is I spend at least a half hour before the call exploring the website, seeing different things, you know, digging into some different things. And then I do the half hour recording. And so that has turned out to be much more impactful and much more useful. And it's almost always a much better perspective and much better advice. And it's much more clear because I'll actually just take notes during the first half hour. And then I can just run through those notes and be like, boom, I noticed this, I noticed this, I noticed this. And so that's that, right? So I was doing that up until a couple weeks ago. And at this point, I've done close to 100 of those. And I was charging anywhere between $150, sometimes $200, sometimes $300, depending on how much inflow I was getting. So I've made, I don't know, probably about $10,000, $15,000 from that. But then all of this was in preparation for putting out a course because I knew I wanted something that I could just sell that I don't have to spend all my time on. And so a couple weeks ago, I pushed out a landing page with a sign up that you can sign up for my course. And during the last like 6 months or so, I've been writing about my ideas around SEO, but I didn't have anything formally completed, like a publishable thing that I could, you know, send out to people. And so I had all this writing and I had this moment where I'm like, you know what, I think I can put out the course. I think I can do it. And so I put out this cohort based course and I said, sign up 25 slots. It's $100, you know, over the next 2 weeks, I'll take you through these four phases of SEO and, you know, I'll teach you SEO. And at the end, you're going to have a much better, you know, understanding of how SEO works. And so then over the last like 3 weeks or so, I had to pull at least like four almost all-nighters where I was turning that writing that I was doing into slides and a video production and actually making the course itself. So that was an interesting 2 weeks. And so basically like almost like the night before, you know, a module was going to be released, I was making the information. And so, so it's been an interesting last couple of weeks, but the feedback on the course was phenomenal. People really loved it. They thought it was really good. Very impactful for them. So this is where the small bets framework works really well. I went into this very objectively, right? Like I didn't know that I knew everything about SEO. So like, oh, I'm just going to put out a course because I know everything about SEO, right? I approached it from a perspective of, okay, I'm going to try this. I'm going to do the consultations. I'm going to learn some stuff, figure out some stuff, get feedback on my own advice, because that's what the consultations were, is people giving me feedback on what my advice is. And so now I have the feedback loop tuned correctly where my advice is great and I can give great advice and people love my advice. And so now I'm confident I could put out a course that's really valuable and helpful to people. So that's where I'm at. And so now I'm tweaking on the course. So the plan is basically to every month collect more feedback on the course and tweak and iterate on it, add more examples, more information, add more clarity, just really enhance the course over time. And then the eventual goal is to have a course that you can purchase where like you just get all the information and you can take it at your own pace for, you know, a lower fee. But then I'll also have a cohort based course where I will go through it with you and I will actually help you set up a website that's SEO optimized. I'll help you do keyword research. I'll help you do these things and it'll cost, you know, $1,000, $2,000 or whatever. But it's basically a guaranteed way that you're setting your website up for success for the SEO.
Quite interesting, because also based on this, you can maybe in addition, upload the course on Udemy, just like Hassan does, and even write a book and post it on Amazon. So you can do all three, four things at the same time. Yep. And eventually it can become a consultation to, you know, companies and stuff like that, where you're going to be charging like $500,000 the hour or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you'll be like, who's this Mahmoud? I don't want to talk to this guy anymore. And
The interesting thing is, the SEO market is absolutely massive, you know, and then writing this or doing this type of consultancy / agency / course thing is a very tried and true method of actually, you know, producing income. So it's not really a guess as to whether it's valuable or whether or not I can make money doing it. I know without a shadow of a doubt, I can make a bunch of money doing it. So I think it's a very safe bet, right?
It is a safe bet, but the question is, and we can end with this, is SEO going forward? Is this, yeah. uh, with search engines and stuff like that. I saw you tweeted something about it, but yeah, you can tell us more.
I have an interesting perspective on it. I think there's different types of SEO, and so this is actually something that I've learned over the last several months. That's really helped me hone in how I do SEO, because there's tons of websites in the internet where their main source of income is advertising, you know, like banner ads and things like that. And so they have a very different SEO approach where they're always just trying to maximize the number of visitors that come to their site. Because if there's more visitors, then there's more eyeballs in the ads, and then I make more money, right? Whereas for like my Clause Tools business, right, I don't care if a million people from India visit my website, because they're not my customers. They're not going to sign up for my business, you know, my tool. They're not going to sign up for a subscription, right? So I don't really care about how much traffic I get. I care about the quality of traffic, that I'm getting the exact person on my webpage that would be a potential customer for my business. So for the audience-based ad/affiliate revenue sites, AI stuff is very scary, right? Because now people can just get answers from AI, and they don't have to go to your wedding planning website to learn about, you know, what's the best way to set up a wedding or something like that, right? Like they don't have to do that anymore. Whereas for businesses that produce content that has some sort of opinion around the best way of doing something, and then they tie in their product as, you know, the solution to a problem or something like that. Number one, it works really well because it's content that you can publish on, you know, any number of mediums, right? Like you post it on social media, you can email list, right? Like you can push that out to an audience. But the thing that, at least right now, currently today, ChatGPT and those AI tools, they can't form opinions about anything. If you ask it, you know, what's the best this, what's the best that, it says, you know, oh, as an LLM, you know, thing, I can't tell you, you know, what's the best or what's going to work out for you. I can give you these facts, like, okay, like, you know, these things make sense, but I can't really tell you what's the best thing, right? Whereas human produced content, you know, by businesses and things like that, you can actually give an opinion, and you can say, look, if this is your context, if this is your situation, these are the things that you're dealing with, this is what we perceive as the best way of doing things. And so at least as of right now, I think that's where businesses have an advantage with content, is because it has an opinion. And then you can tie in your product as a solution to that problem. Because what's going to happen is you're going to Google something, and then the LLM is going to be like, oh, I can't really help you with that. And then they're going to jump down to the results, and they're going to click on whatever's ranking, right? But then on the second point, is that these AI tools are based on the open web, right? Like they were trained on the open web. And so if you're not producing content for the open web, you're not training these AI tools to give answers with your product or your business as the solution to a problem in that context, right? So like if you're not actually producing that content, you're not going to show up for anything. You know, you'll have to rely on some other form of marketing, you know, whether it's, you know, advertising or, you know, going viral on social media or something like that, right? So because these AI tools are based on the open web, that means that the open web becomes the AI training tool. And so the better content that you produce, okay, so actually, let me take a step back. The really unique thing about Google is that Google has done the due diligence to figure out what is authoritative content and what is not, right? It did that work. And so that's actually a really high signal for these AI tools, because they don't have to, you know, look at the entire internet and know like, oh man, like, is this actually the right information or is this the right information? Google did that for them. They did that ranking for them. So they know like, oh, you know, this is actually the most authoritative source of this information. And this over here, yes, somebody produced it, but it has very little weight compared to this thing, because this thing was ranked really high. You know, it gets a lot, you know, Google perceives this as very trustworthy. So that PageRank algorithm really helped build these AI tools that are really helpful and very useful, right? And so if you are not doing SEO well, you're not going to rank well, you're not going to be perceived by these AI tools as authoritative on this topic, and you're not going to be in these LLM systems as either recommending your tool or, you know, giving opinions that align, you know, well with your systems or whatever you produce or something like that. So yes, I think direct traffic from Google is going to go down, right? Like direct clicks from Google is going to go down. But long term, the open internet is undeniably the best place to produce information, to, you know, attract customers, to produce long-term traffic for your business. I think it's 100% still worth betting on, and building an audience based on the open web, I think, is really important long-term.
Yeah, I do agree as well in that sense. And that's why with time, as you said, human-produced content, even if it's web, along with the help of ChatGPT, is going to be more interesting because of the opinions. Let's wait and see if GPT will eventually come up with opinions
have or better or opinions something. Than
imagine,
us,
yeah. Yeah. But that's going to definitely be interesting. Jordan, thank you very much. This was really insightful and quite valuable content, which is going to be out there. Well, for me, it's for free, so thank you very much. And for those who are listening, but yeah, where can people find you? And are you going to be doing more courses?
So mostly you can find me on Twitter. I'm at JDNOC on Twitter. My personal website is JDNOC.com. I do some blog writing on there. I haven't been doing as much recently, but I definitely plan on doing more going forward. And then I'm going to be doing the SEO course coming up. So there's the link in my bio is to ranktosell.com, which is my SEO venture. And you can sign up for the course there. And mostly on Twitter though, you'll hear what I'm working on, projects I'm working on, small bets I'm taking, you know, progress with closet tools, things like that. So yeah.
Sounds good. Thank you very much. And see you around.
See ya.
Cheers.